Well, as we continue in 1 Samuel chapter 14 to this evening, we're going to reread a major portion of this chapter in just a few minutes. Since it is long and it's involved, we won't even finish this chapter today. Now, the scene that's unfolding is of King Saul's first war with the Philistines. But also we see this uneasy relationship that Saul has with his son, Yonatan, and how this is going to play out over several years, especially as the young David becomes identified as the Lord's Nagid, the prince, the king in waiting to replace Shaul at just that right moment. Now at Gilgal, Saul was accepted by Israel as their first king, and the very reason that people initially wanted a king quickly became his primary vocation. Saul would immediately lead Israel in defense from an enemy from the east, the nation of Ammon. And now, in 1 Samuel chapter 14, he would lead the tribes against a familiar and formidable enemy from the west, the Philistines. Now, the Philistines had established a number of forts and encampments in Canaan, primarily in the central hill country called the Mountains of Ephraim. And one such place was Saul's hometown. Typically, we say Gibeah, but more correctly, it's pronounced Geba, in his tribal territory of Benjamin. Another outpost was established in a more remote location called Michmash. Now, another important strategic pass from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean seacoast, well, this is the focal point of the battle described in chapter 14. Michmash was perched on the north side of the pass. See this pass running through here on the north side. And basically, this pass was a ravine formed by a wadi, a dry riverbed. Now, on the opposite side was Israelite-controlled Geba. Now, Saul had marched his 600 men from Gilgal to Geba when this story commences. And we find Saul kind of lollygagging around near a pomegranate tree that he made his field headquarters. Now, I say lollygagging around because it's apparent Saul wasn't quite sure what he planned on doing about this. And so we're about to see his son, Yonatan, take the initiative to bring to an end this indecisiveness of his father. And instead, he was going to force a confrontation with the enemy. Now, this isn't the first time that Jonathan got sick and tired of waiting for his father, the king, to do something and not just talk about it. When Saul couldn't seem to generate enough enthusiasm to get the Israelites to join with him in sufficient force to confront this Philistine threat, Yonatan solved this problem by assassinating a Philistine governor who was stationed in Geba. This act had its desired effect of so outraging the Philistine leadership that they stepped up their oppression of Israel to a level that even the most reluctant Israeli clan and tribal leaders couldn't find an excuse to sit it out any longer, and because their personal freedom was now in danger of evaporating. Well, an unflattering picture of Saul is emerging. And I'm sorry to say, that picture is very much like a stereotype of a modern politician. He talks a good game, but he wouldn't act unless there was sufficient personal benefit that at the same time also minimized his own personal risk. He purported to be the leader of Israel, but generally just observed where the parade was already headed. Then he grabbed a baton and jumped in front of it to take credit. His courage was measured primarily by the level of support from those who agreed with him. He melted quickly if he felt the opposition was too great. And while at times he ordered the people to scrupulously obey the law of Moses or bear the consequences, he also tended to play fast and loose with Jehovah's commandments, and he felt he was kind of above the law. Saul's outward demeanor of bombast and bravado, well, that masked an inward insecurity, a timidity, and of course a lack of character. Everything that God had demanded of a king, Saul couldn't deliver. But of course the Lord knew that, because that was at the heart of the reason that he chose Saul in the first place. Saul was not only stereotypical of our modern politicians, but also of the Middle Eastern kings and the small-time potentates of that era. King Shaul was exactly what those Israelite tribal leaders had in mind as the model of a monarch that they felt sure was the answer to all their problems. Well, as we pick up our story today, Jonathan knows that his father's gonna do nothing until his hand's forced. And so simply, he could no longer accept this frustrating idleness in the face of the Philistines arrogantly setting up yet another outpost on Israelite land. Without consulting his father, the brave Yonatan took his armor bearer with him and he challenged the Philistines to do battle. So let's pick this up in 1 Samuel chapter 14, starting at verse 8. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that is page 311. 1 Samuel chapter 14, we'll start at verse 8. Yonatan said, "Here, we'll cross over to those men and let them know we're there. And if they say, 'Wait till we come to you,' we'll stand where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come on up,' we'll go on up. And that will be the sign that Adonai has given us victory over them." So both of them let their presence be known to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, some Hebrews are coming out of their holes that they've been hiding in." And then the men of the garrison said to Yonatan and his armor bearer, "Come on up to us. We want to show you something." Jonathan told his armor bearer, "Come on up after me, because Adonai has handed them over to Israel." Jonathan climbed up, using his hands as well as his feet, with his armor bearer behind him. And the Philistines fell before Yonatan, and his armor bearer following behind him finished him off. That first slaughter of about 20 men was accomplished by Yonatan and his armor bearer in a space only about half as long as one side of the area of a pair of oxen could plow in a day. There was a panic in the field camp among all the Philistim. Likewise, the garrison and the raiding party panicked. Besides all this, there was an earthquake. Thus it grew into a panic caused by God. Shaul's men on watch in Givat Benjamin could see the enemy camp scattering, running in all directions. And Shaul ordered the forces with him to call the roll, see who was missing. So they called the roll, and they found Jonathan and his armor bearer weren't present. And Shaul told Achia, "Bring the Ark of God here." For at that time, the Ark of God was with the people of Israel. But while Saul was talking to the Kohen, the priest, the uproar in the camp of the Philistines continued. It kept getting louder, and Saul said to the Kohen, "Put your hand down." Saul and the entire force with him assembled and went to battle, but they found the Philistines all fighting each other in utter confusion. And the Hebrews from the surrounding countryside, who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them into the camp, well, they deserted. And they went over to Israel with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, on hearing that the Philistines were fleeing, all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hills of Ephraim pursued them in battle. So Adonai saved Israel that day, and the battle spread as far as Beth Aven. Well, Israel's soldiers had been driven to exhaustion that day. But Shaul issued this warning to the people, "A curse on any man who eats any food until evening, when I will have finished taking vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people even tasted food. Now the people came to a forest where there was a honeycomb on the ground. And when the people had entered the forest, they saw there the honeycomb dripping with honey. But no one would put his hand to his mouth because the people feared the oath. But Yehonathan hadn't heard his father charging the people with the oath. So he put out the end of his staff in his hand and he dipped it up in the honeycomb and he raised it up to his mouth, whereupon his eyes lit up. But one of the people said in response, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath. A curse on any man who eats any food today, even though the people are fainting with hunger." And Jonathan answered, "My father's brought trouble to the land. Just look how my eyes have lit up because I tasted just a little of this honey. How much greater would the slaughter of the Philistines have been today than if the people had eaten freely of the spoil they had found with their enemies?" Well, that day they attacked the Philistines from Michmash to Ayalon. But the people were very exhausted. So the people rushed at the spoil, seizing sheep and cows and calves and slaughtering them on the ground and eating the flesh with the blood. And Shaul was told, "Look how the people are sinning against Adonai, eating the blood." And he said, "You have not kept faith. Roll a big stone to me immediately." "Now," Shaul said, "go around among the people and tell them, each of you is to bring his cow and his sheep and slaughter them here. Then eat. Don't sin against Adonai by eating with the blood." So each person brought his animal with him that evening and killed it there. And Shaul erected an altar to Adonai. It was the first altar that he erected to Adonai. And Saul said, "Let's go after the Philistines by night. We'll plunder them until dawn. We won't leave one of them alive." And they answered, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest said, "Let's approach God here." Shaul consulted God. "Should I go down in pursuit of the Philistines? Will you hand them over to Israel?" But he didn't answer him that day. And Saul said, "Come here, all you heads of the people. Think carefully. Who has committed this sin today? For as Adonai, Israel's deliverer, lives, even if it proves to be Jonathan, my own son, he must be put to death." But no one among all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You be on one side, I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side." And the people replied to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Saul said to Adonai, the God of Israel, "Who is right? Jonathan and Saul were chosen by lot, and the people went free." Saul said, "Cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son." Jonathan was chosen. And then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you did." And Jonathan told him, "Yes, I tasted a little honey with the end of the staff in my hand. Here I am. I'm ready to die." And Shaul said, "May God do the same to me and more also if you are not put to death, Jonathan." But the people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Heaven forbid. As Adonai lives, not one hair of his head will fall to the ground because he worked with God today." In this way, the people rescued Jonathan so that he didn't die. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines returned to their own territory. So Saul took over the rulership of Israel, and he fought against all of his enemies on every side, against Moab, the people of Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. No matter which way he turned, he defeated them. He demonstrated his strength by attacking Amalek. He saved Israel from the power of those who were plundering them. The sons of Shaul were Yehonatan, Ishvi, and Malchishua, while the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the older, Merav, and of the younger, Michal. Shaul's wife was named Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahima'atz. The commander of his army was named Avner, the son of Ner, Shaul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul. Ner, the follower of Abner, was the son of Abiel. And as long as Saul lived, there was bitter war against the Philistines. Wherever Saul saw any strong or courageous man, he recruited him into his service. We're reminded of David's encounter with Goliath as we read of Jonathan's faith and certainty that if the Lord wants Israel delivered, it doesn't matter whether it's accomplished by the means of two men or 200. Numbers just don't matter. See, the idea was this. Jonathan and his servant, here he's called an armor bearer, would see how the Philistines responded to their provocation. If a Philistine soldier said, come on up, or rather, stay there until we come down to you, that's what they do. If they say, come on up towards us, then this was a sign from God so that they would believe it, and then they would go on up to them. Now, I have to tell you, if we were there at that time, I'm not sure how many of us would regard Jonathan's plan as a very good and commendable faith, or as probably more a suicidal and a brash attempt to test God by means of a couple of guys suffering from a testosterone rush. My nature is such that not only would I probably not take Jonathan's approach, but if I was that armor bearer, I'd ask for a transfer. I mean, but what's sort of hidden here is a lesson for us all about how the Lord makes use of those who inhabit his kingdom and trust him in all things. In many ways, Jonathan was just like his father. Impetuous, kind of a show-off, hot-tempered, rash. But the difference is that Jonathan was as unselfish as Saul was selfish. He was as noble as Saul was base. Jonathan was determined in his faith and his belief in God's power and wisdom and ability to deliver, as Saul was determined that he could kind of manipulate the Lord for his own purposes and risk nothing personally. We see how two men of essentially the same temperament and the same personality can at the same time be so opposite in their natures. Saul was being used by the Lord. He was being used to show us everything that a leader of the kingdom of God should not be. Jonathan was a demonstration of what can happen when a person focuses on God and not on his circumstances. King Saul was led by his own lusts, his own desires, his own inner demons. Jonathan was led by the Holy Spirit. And despite the deep faults and troublesome personality traits that characterized both of them, their destinies were night and day apart due to the single, all-encompassing personal choice that they had made, each of them, at some point in their lives. Would they or would they not obey the Lord at all costs? Yonatan and his anonymous servant have agreed on this daring strategy to walk out into the open and make their presence known to the enemy. One can only imagine the surprise of these Philistine soldiers as these two lonely Hebrews stood down there in the valley shouting up at them. The startled soldiers were stationed on a promontory where they could see a couple of miles in all directions. And it was obvious that these two foolish fellows were either drunk or stupid, maybe both, because indeed there weren't any other fellow Israelites in sight. And not quite sure what to make of these two, and probably not just a little bit suspicious, they weren't about to crawl down from their safe perch overlooking that dry riverbed. So in typical Middle Eastern fashion, they started shouting back and boasting and challenging them to come on up. Now, I have no doubt that after a few minutes of heaping abuse on these Israelites that they had so little regard for, they'd figured they'd had their fun. It's all over, and so they kind of relaxed. But the words of those Philistines were the signal that Jonathan had hoped for. So convinced was he that the Lord was now firmly on his side and that the unction he felt to undertake this excursion had to be of God, that he and his armor bearer crawled stealthily up the north face of that ravine in a very steep part where the Philistine soldiers could never have expected them to show up. And when they got to the top, it turned out to be a very narrow area that the Bible describes as the length of a rather standard furrow that an ox team could plow in a day and only about half as wide. This meant they were practically in a long, narrow tunnel, probably one, maybe two. Philistine soldiers at a time could even fight against Jonathan. So Jonathan would disable a soldier, he'd move on to the next one, while his armor bearer would finish him off in turn. Here, done with this one, let me go to the next one, you take care of him, off he went. Now understand, Jonathan had no idea when he hatched this brazen plot that the terrain was going to be so beneficial that a two-man team could effectively fight off a much larger company of enemy soldiers. Not only did his faith prove completely founded, but as what happens with most worshipers of God, one successful step of faith can lead to a next one, a more bold one yet. About 20 of the enemy were killed in the fight, and the yelling and the screaming and all the commotion that was going on, well, it woke up the rest of the camp, and they were certain they were under attack. Having no idea that the attack was merely the foray of two lonely Hebrews, this substantial garrison of Philistine soldiers flew into a panic. To top it all off, there was an earthquake, all the more to accentuate the Lord's fingerprints all over this operation. Now, because the encampment of Saul was only about a mile away, and because some Israelite watchmen were set up an outpost so they could spy on the Philistines at Michmash, they noticed all this confusion going on. They saw the enemy running around, seemingly disoriented, and they reported it to Saul. Now, only one cause for stirring up this ant's nest made any sense. Somebody from his troops was over there, unauthorized, and had aroused the Philistines. King Saul immediately ordered a roll call. Sure enough, Jonathan. Jonathan and his armor bearer were missing. I don't imagine he was all that surprised. Saul, being aware of his son's spirit, didn't at all put it past him to attempt this sort of desperate undertaking on his own without permission from Dad. The mystery resolved, the ever indecisive Saul calls for his high priest, Achiah, told him to bring the Ark of God. Now, exactly where the Ark was at this time, we can't know for sure. However, the last time we heard of it, its long-term home was in Kiryat Yearim, in the home of a priest. However, very likely it was currently traveling with this group. And even the reticent Saul wouldn't have waited for days to address this emergency. It was usual that the ark was carried to the site of the battle. So it's hard to imagine that Saul would have allowed it to have remained in Kiryat Yearim. Well, with one eye on the Philistine camp that was surging and scattering, and yet with his instinct to consult God on the matter before he acted tugging on him, Saul decided he couldn't wait. He loses his patience. So as the high priest was in the process of seeking the Lord's favor, Saul interrupts him and says, "Oh, put your hand down. What's going on?" See, the high priest would have been using the Urim and Tumim stones to obtain the divine answers to Saul's questions about what he ought to do. These two stones were kept in a special pocket in the high priest's ephod. And his hand would go inside the pocket to remove and then put back the stones as a means of inquiry. And as usual, Saul liked the idea of seeking the Lord on matters, but as often as not, he had much or more confidence in his own decisions. So he simply prematurely stopped the process of the high priest consulting the Lord. So King Saul quickly assembles his troops. They race over to the camp of the Philistines to take advantage of this chaotic situation. And when he arrives, he finds that in the midst of all this confusion, the Philistines are fighting and killing each other. And part of the reason this was happening was because some of the Israelite clan members who had cut their own deals with the Philistines, and so they were peacefully camping with them at the time, had now turned on their new buddies and started killing them. The Philistines didn't know who was enemy and who was friend. Not only that, but many of the Hebrews who had been in hiding saw the opportunity to decimate these Philistines. And so they joined with Saul and his 600 and chased down and killed a lot of the fleeing enemy. Well, thanks to Jonathan's courage to obey the Lord and go forth at great personal risk, it was a rout. And that area was cleared of the Philistine threat for a time. Well, these battles of old were long affairs. When soldiers engaged in battle, it was usually until the sun set, and no one on either side could see well enough to continue after that. Stamina was as important as ability. Both sides eventually became exhausted, thirsty, and famished to the point of collapse. Blood sugar levels were critically low. Dehydration was setting in, and it was quite usual in battle to have warriors literally faint and be killed while they lay on the ground, not injured, just unconscious. But Saul, who undoubtedly had multiple attendants, not only protecting him, but supplying him with food and drink and plenty of time to rest, well, he ordered his weary men to continue pursuing the Philistines until he was satisfied that the victory was total. Saul was yielding to yet another of his characteristic impulses. Although what his army needed most was some food and some water and just a little bit of rest, he not only ordered them to continue without food and water, but also made them take a solemn oath, a vow before God to not even taste food until Saul allowed it. Or, as the super selfish king put it, they weren't to eat again until I have finished taking vengeance on my enemies. Not Israel's enemies. Not God's enemies. This was, after all, holy war. My enemies. In but a couple of years on the throne, Saul has quickly adopted the attitude of a despot. His men were just cannon fodder. And all wars were about his personal pride and status among the nations. Now, while it's difficult to understand any religious motive of Saul's to make the men take this oath to not eat, without doubt in Saul's mind, religion was playing a role. Very likely he thought that this was a pious act on his part that would impress God and curry his favor. As stupid, rash, destructive as this vow was, Middle Eastern resolve is such that even had he come to his senses, Saul couldn't take it back without losing face and taking the sin of reneging on this vow upon his own shoulders. The people, on the other hand, well, they fully understand that even though they were, in a sense, forced into this, they had indeed said amen to the oath. So now they were bound. This was a very serious matter. Saul declared an oath with a divine curse attached to it, and this meant that despite the irrational and unwarranted nature of the oath, it was absolutely valid in all of its details and all of its terms in God's eyes. A God principle that goes back to Exodus, Leviticus, and to the book of Judges teaches us that the Lord is not in the business of seeking vows and oaths from his people as a sign of their piousness. The New Testament has Yeshua advising against vows and oaths, not because they were tradition or superstition or no longer in operation, but because they remain just as powerful and as much in effect as they did in the ancient days. However, if one chooses to make a vow or to join in with a group vow, then one is obligated to follow through with it, otherwise the attached curse will be on their head. Well, these Hebrew soldiers were in such awe of the Lord that they risked their lives on the battlefield by continuing to fight in their weakened condition in order to obey the oath rather than risk antagonizing Jehovah. Now, I kind of wonder, does this kind of fear and awe remain in us, the church? You know, it ought to, I think. But sadly, a misguided Christian doctrine that sprang up sometime during the era of the early Roman Church has endangered millions of believers by saying that faith in the Messiah means the end of our obligation to be obedient to God. And since there's no further need for obedience, any kind of breaking of the Lord's commandments is generally inconsequential. Yeshua made it clear that such a thing is patently absurd. And he warned that it was much safer for a worshiper of Jehovah to simply respond yes or no. Don't add an oath or a vow to anything, since the Lord will expect us to do whatever it is we vowed in His name. And this is because a vow indeed attaches God's name to a promise. So it now puts His holy name and reputation at risk. So He can't just turn a blind eye to this. And verse 25 explains that Saul's army entered this forested region, where apparently many large colonies of bees lived, and there was an abundant honeycomb all over the place. Now honey, devash, in Hebrew, was prized, not only for its wonderful taste, but for its ability to revive a person who was famished or in a weakened condition by rapidly raising their blood sugar level, kind of like the way chocolate was used in World War II by our military. But as terribly as they needed it, and as marvelous a gift from heaven provided by the Father that it was, Saul's vow prohibited the people from partaking of it. And so with great discipline, they passed it by. They didn't take so much as a taste. But Jonathan, well, he hadn't heard of his father's rash commandment, so he took advantage of this fortuitous find. And one of the soldiers saw what Jonathan did, and he told him of this oath against the army eating that his father demanded. And this infuriated Jonathan. And just as Saul well knew of his son's indomitable spirit and strong faith in Jehovah, so Jonathan well understood his father's bent on issuing morally reprehensible orders, ill-conceived commandments on a whim, on an impulse. So Jonathan publicly denounced his father's ridiculous attitude and says that Saul has brought a lot of trouble to this land. That in fact this oath had caused the Israelites to have a lot less of a victory over the Philistines than they could have had if they'd just been allowed to eat and regain their strength. One comment. While the other soldiers were duty-bound to this oath and would have suffered at God's hand had they transgressed it, Jonathan wasn't in the same position. He hadn't even heard of the oath. He hadn't agreed to it. The Lord had providentially kept Jonathan busy elsewhere, so it had no effect upon him. Well, in verse 31, we get the key words that day, the people kept on fighting without ceasing and without food, and so when sunset came, they began to eat the captured domestic animals. Well, verse 24 said that the oath was a curse on any man who eats any food until evening. This is meaning the same day as the oath was taken. So the oath ended upon sunset, when the current day ended and a new day began. And the narrator of 1 Samuel explains that they were so hungry that they just took those animals, slaughtered them on the ground, and cut them up as they lay in pools of their own blood and ate it, just like that. The issue is not that they ate the animals raw. They probably didn't. It's that they didn't properly drain the blood from the meat before cooking it, and so they broke the commandment to refrain from eating blood. We find that in Leviticus 17:10. When someone from the community of Israel or one of the foreigners living with you eats any kind of blood, I will set myself against that person who eats blood, and I'm going to cut him off from his people. The Lord is serious about this. Eating blood doesn't only mean to literally drink blood or to drain and store the blood and then make some kind of food out of it later. It also means that the meat has to be properly drained, reasonably free of blood, before cooking it. In fact, in ancient times, especially during the Second Temple era, enormous quantities of salt was used for this very purpose, because salt is a good absorbent of liquid. The blood-contaminated salt was then thrown out into the roadways and the pathways, and it acted like a poison to kill the vegetation on the ground. So it would keep the pathways from becoming overgrown. And we're given an example of what happens with this waste salt in this very well-known passage from the New Testament in Matthew 5:13. You are salt for the land, but if salt becomes tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except being thrown out for people to trample upon. The reference being of salt being thrown out for people to trample on was quite literal, and it was a common everyday occurrence that served a very useful purpose in ancient Israel for the nation's network of roads and pathways. Well, when Saul found out about his army not properly draining the blood, he ordered that a large stone was brought to him, and then each man was to slaughter his animal on the stone so that Saul could oversee the process. By slaughtering an animal on a flat stone, the blood would flow out of the meat to the edge of the stone and drip onto the ground, and this was considered the standard way for blood to be drained away from an animal for it to be ritually clean, at least in that era. The people understood the sin of what they had been doing, as well as Saul did, but they were so hungry due to the king's rash edict that they just accepted the consequence of the sin as a price they were willing to pay to hurry up and eat. Now, what a great lesson we can take from this for a leader of any kind. From a parent, to a small business owner, to a Fortune 500 CEO, to a government official, to a pastor, to a rabbi. When we put merciless, unreasonable, uncaring demands and requirements on those that we're in charge of, and they fail, we as leaders are at least as much at fault because we put them in a position where failure was almost a certainty. Parents can be too strict. Bosses can be too demanding. Congregational leaders can be too rigid, too quick to evoke self-righteous and burdensome doctrines upon people that go far beyond their biblical intent. The rabbis became infamous for this kind of thing in the form of thousands of often burdensome, if not downright silly, traditions, rules. And Yeshua spoke out against these harsh doctrines and traditions and man-made edicts, and he offered a return to the true intent of the Torah. Matthew 11:28, come to me, all of you who are struggling and burdened. I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me, because I'm gentle and humble in heart. And you're going to find rest for your souls because my yoke is easy My burden's light. Saul was not wrong in stopping his army from eating blood. He was wrong in that it was his own harsh act that caused the sin of all those men in the first place. Thus, from God's viewpoint, this blood sin was as much on his head as it was on theirs. Well, in verse 36, after the people were refreshed by eating and resting for a little while, and as Saul was pondering the day's events that he could not have helped but recall the story of Joshua and his nocturnal pursuit of Israel's enemies several centuries earlier. So his proposal was that the army put sleep aside that night, and they go after the fleeing remnant of the Philistines. And all this was willingly accepted by his rank and file. Well, the priests, properly so, countered by saying they should consult God here. Here is undoubtedly referring to the altar that Saul had built where they were currently resting. And Saul naturally agreed, and he asked two questions of God through the high priest. First, should he pursue the Philistines that night? And second, will Saul's army be victorious? But the Lord was silent. He gave him no reply. And we are again witnessing the use of the Urim and Thummim stones by the high priest. It is thought that these stones can essentially provide no more than a yes-no type of answer. Thus, when the priest put his hand into this special pocket sewn into his ephod where the stones reside, pulling out one stone meant yes, pulling out the other stone meant no. So questions had to be phrased in a yes, no, true, false, either or kind of fashion. So exactly what the indication was that God provided no answer to the questions, that brings a lot of speculation. Tradition says that one stone or the other would literally glow or shine, thus indicating God's decision. Certainly it must be the case before us that either the high priest was somehow supernaturally aware that the Lord was withholding his oracle, or that indeed the stones themselves changed in some visible and obvious way when an answer was forthcoming, but this time their state remained static, unchanged. Well, when no answer was given, the only possible explanation for such divine silence was that some sin had been committed, and it had displeased the Lord, and thus he had pulled away from Israel. And the only solution to uncover this sin, punish the trespasser, was to punish the trespasser and then make proper atonement for it. Shaul naturally never thought to look at himself. So in verse 38, he just assumes that one of his army's leaders either personally sinned or knew of sin within their ranks. So he assembles all of his military officers and he wants to know, all right, who committed this sin? This sin doesn't necessarily mean that Saul specifically even knew what kind of sin had been committed. He only meant that this sin, whatever it was, has caused the Lord to withdraw. So somebody, tell me how you sinned. No one stepped forward to confess any sin. So Saul used the other standard religious method of advancing towards the truth, casting lots. We're going to look at the results of what essentially was a divine trial next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.